Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Mark Weber back on the show. Mark is a historian, lecturer, and current affairs analyst. He's the director of the Institute for Historical Review, an independent educational research and publishing center that is dedicated to free speech and free historical inquiry. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Tim. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you for coming back on. Now, is that a fair summation of what the IHR is dedicated to, what it's all about?
It's fair, but it's limited. Of course, we try to deal with historical issues that are relevant today, including what we're going to talk about in this program, the Second World War, which is constantly cited by people on for various reasons. For its relevance to the present, but also the recent wars of the United States and the Middle East and Iraq war and so forth. And we try to deal with current affairs and events as they happen from a historical perspective. And obviously, we try to do so in a way that's not just a mainstream, but a dissonant point of view, because the problems of these wars over and over it repeats itself. That is, the United States continues to carry out wars and bomb, invade, and attack other countries, seemingly without learning what we think, in a way, should be the obvious lessons from past experiences. And we continue to repeat them over and over for reasons which we try to get into. But yeah, I mean, what we said was fair. But we can sort of fine tune and be more focused in what it is we try to do. And I urge people, of course, if they'll see a lot more on our website, IHR.org, and they'll find that we deal with a really vast range of topics, but all of them held together in the way that we're talking about right now.
Okay, well, tonight we first wanted to talk about this movie that came out earlier this year, The Darkest Hour, a story of Winston Churchill, particularly in that moment in 1940 during the so-called Blitz. Now, Winston Churchill is considered by many to be the man of the century. That would be the 20th century. He's seen as many as sort of a hero, a sort of a Leonidas holding the past against the forces of barbarism and tyranny. This would have been his role in the summer of 1940, after the fall of France, and England supposedly stood alone against Nazi Germany conquering the world. That's sort of the crude historical vision that many people have gotten, through Hollywood, or through the textbooks, popular history, the received history. And this article, and you've done a lot of work kind of deconstructing Winston Churchill, perhaps making more of a human being out of him than sort of the icon that he is. And you saw this movie, you wrote this article reviewing the movie and maybe shedding some truth on who Winston Churchill was. So let's start with this. Winston Churchill, the man of the greatest man of the 20th century. What's your take on Winnie?
Well, because the Second World War is presented as the ultimate battle between good and evil in the 20th century, and of course the United States was came out of the war as a great victor, that war is cited over and over by people as the good war that had to be fought. Everybody agrees that of course there's a lot of dispute and argument about the justice and the proper, but whether the United States should have invaded Iraq or Vietnam and so forth. But there's generally a very strong feeling, well, the Second World War was really the good war. And in that conflict, the person who's held up by over and over is Winston Churchill, because he had been very hostile to Germany before he became prime minister. And of course, between 1939 and America's formal entry into the war with Pearl Harbor, Britain was the United States was not in. So Churchill was considered the man for standing up to this terrible tyranny. And this movie, Darkest Hour, it's a good movie. I mean, it's as I write, it's a great movie, but defective history. The central actor in the movie playing Churchill is Gary Oldman. he's a very good actor, and he gets a lot of nuances and features of Churchill's character and mannerisms down very well, and he's very good in that way. But the movie is fundamentally a movie that's a heroic presentation and fundamentally a very inaccurate presentation about Winston Churchill and the situation as it really existed in the spring, early summer of 1940 when the movie takes place. Now, for those who haven't seen it, it's probably necessary to just mention again what the movie is about. Again, it was a big blockbuster. Gary Oldman received the Oscar a prize for his portrayal of Churchill in the movie, and I think justifiably so. But the movie takes place after the Germans have succeeded in surprisingly driving out French forces and British forces in Norway. In fact, a campaign that was a fiasco and was the brainchild, above all, of Churchill himself, who at that time was head of the British Navy. And it was such a fiasco. The person who was blamed for the fiasco was Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. And Neville Chamberlain lost support, so Churchill becomes Prime Minister just as German forces attack and overwhelm British and French forces in Belgium and France in 1940. And the situation goes from, as I say in the review, from bad to worse. And they bring this out in the movie. And the German forces are throw back the French, of course. The French are suing for peace. And the British are at Dunkirk, ready to leave. Well, at this point, it's very clear that Britain is facing the greatest defeat and catastrophe of modern times militarily. And within the cabinet, within his own government, there was a general consensus that under the circumstances, the best that Britain should do is to try to bring about some agreement with Germany. And Churchill is shown as a man in the movie who's unsure quite what to do. And then a key episode comes up in the movie, which is entirely invented, in which he goes down on the subway and talks to just ordinary people to ask them what they think, and overwhelmingly they say, no, we've got to keep fighting, and so he gets out and goes to Parliament and announces in this very rousing speech that concludes the movie that he was never going to surrender, Britain was going to fight to the end, and so all thought of any kind of peace agreement with Hitler is quashed, and that's how the movie ends. Well, the movie is essentially just fiction for a lot of reasons. For one thing, Churchill was not one to pay much attention at all to what the British public opinion was. That was throughout his career. In fact, Churchill became a prime minister in 1940 precisely because in the 1930s he had been so vehement in his opposition, contrary to public opinion. Public opinion in Britain was not bellicose and anywhere near as hostile as Churchill, but because he had been so out of step with public opinion, he became prime minister, and entirely invented. Churchill never in his life took a bus. He never bought groceries. He didn't go on the subway. He was a man who was born in privilege. He had very little contact with ordinary people, and he was not really liked by most working-class British people. And the proof of that was that after the end of war in Europe in 1945, and the first elections were held since the beginning of the war, Churchill and his party were thrown out of office and replaced by the Labour Party. But anyway, this scene is entirely invented. But more than that, the idea that Churchill was determined not to surrender and would not therefore reach any kind of a peace, even begin peace negotiations with Germany, is really entirely a distortion of the reality. The fact is that Hitler never wanted Britain to surrender. Hitler wanted merely Britain to stop fighting and attacking Germany. It was Britain that declared war on Germany, not the other way around. Britain declared war claiming, in 1939, Britain declared war on Germany on the grounds that Germany had violated Polish sovereignty. Well, that was really a pretext, because at the end of the war, Poland had lost its sovereignty, this time to the Soviet Union, and the British went along with that. They cooperated in the Soviet takeover of Poland and, in fact, of all of Eastern Europe. But more than that, Hitler made repeated efforts to try to bring about a peaceful resolution of the conflict between Britain and Germany on a basis that was quite honorable to Britain, and certainly much better than the conditions on which Britain finally ended the war in 1945 with the Soviet Union in control of half of Europe and by far the greatest power on the continent. Because for whatever his faults, Hitler admired Britain. He admired the British Empire. He had no intention whatsoever to try to dismantle it or to do anything that was going to be contrary to the essential interests or the honor of Britain. And so Britain, and Churchill presents the case in his speech that concludes the movie as a choice between carrying on the war to a bitter end, even at the cost of invasion, or allowing the Nazis to take over Britain. And he says swastika flags will be flying over London. Well, that's just nonsense. Germany had allies during the Second World War in Europe, such as Finland or Bulgaria, Romania, and so forth, and Nazi flags never flew over those countries. Hitler didn't ask or want any kind of hegemony or control over Britain. He really wanted the war to stop with Britain, albeit with German, you might say, hegemony in Eastern Europe. So the essential case that's made in the movie, The Darkest Hour, is really a misleading, a false one, an inaccurate one. But it's very thrilling because it makes it seem like Churchill's really being tough. The proof that Britain could have made a peace agreement with Hitler was made privately by Churchill himself. In 1944, as I point out in the review that's on our website of the movie, he privately told Stalin that he could have easily made an agreement with Hitler, and an agreement that would not have cost Britain anything, really, and would have been to the disadvantage primarily not of Britain, but of the Soviet Union. But that was an admission that Churchill made in private, not in public. But even in his memoirs, Churchill concluded that the war was really a tragedy, because at the end of the nearly 6 years of war, 1945, Britain's situation was far worse than it was at the beginning, and worse than it had agreed to with Hitler. Movie and my take on it, and of Churchill and the distortion of the
I'm getting, I'm starting to break up. Can I try to give you a call back?
Sure.
Oh, we're back. Sorry about that. Connection problems. Yeah, it's interesting. You made the point that, like, early in the war, the movie starts with the fiasco in Norway, and that was Churchill's doing. It was his plan. But, the disaster in Norway in, I think it was April 1940, that was more or less the Germans beating the British to the punch, right? Didn't they have plans to invade Denmark and occupy Norway? And weren't they already mining neutral Norwegian waters?
Right. I mean, the British, the German attack against Norway and Denmark, occupation of those countries, was for many years has been presented as a brutal, ruthless German attack on peace-loving Denmark and Norway. In fact, it was Britain that first planned to take Norway, because Germany was shipping iron, high-grade iron ore from Sweden through Norwegian ports to Germany. Norway was neutral, and it was Britain that first began mining and the waters in Norway to stop Norway from being a transshipment point and planning its own attack and takeover of Norway. Norway itself, and the French and the British were preparing their own invasion. Germany anticipated this, and Germany just acted more quickly and cut off the British before they were able to really act very well. And so even that, the Norway campaign was badly presented, but the British didn't prepare well for the campaign. Britain at that time, the head of the British Navy at that time was Winston Churchill. He was Lord of the Admiralty, and the fiasco of Norway was in many ways his failure. But of course, he was not the prime minister, and Neville Chamberlain, who was the prime minister, was had to accept the blame and did get the blame for the catastrophe, which was in many ways largely Churchill's doing. But again, that should have already been a warning of the resourcefulness and the ability of the German soldiers, which were even more manifest in May and June of 1940, when finally the attack in Belgium and France took place and British and French forces were overwhelmed, even though in May 1940, the British and the French had a superiority over the Germans, both in numbers of men, numbers of tanks, and even numbers of airplanes over the Germans. But the Germans acted far more quickly, far more creatively. The morale was better, and they were able to defeat the British and the French pretty quickly.
And it's interesting because you look at Winston Churchill's career. Didn't he also, wasn't Gallipoli his plan too in 1916?
That's interesting because during the movie Darkest Hour, there are a number of points in the movie where unflattering things are brought up about Churchill. At least twice, maybe three times in the movie Darkest Hour, colleagues of Churchill mention his responsibility for the fiasco of the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War. Churchill sent an expeditionary force of British and colonial troops, that is Australians, Canadians, and so forth, to try to take the Bosphorus, the area around Istanbul, from Turkey, which was allied with Germany in the First World War. And it was a disaster. I mean, after tremendous losses, the British had to withdraw. And it was Churchill, who was head of the Navy in the First World War, who was responsible for this campaign. Now, some historians think that with proper management, it could have been successful. I don't know about that. But during the movie Darkest Hour, repeatedly, there are scenes of politicians saying rather unflattering things about Churchill, because Churchill was known to be, by his colleagues, by the public, to be often a reckless man. He was not widely trusted. Colleagues, I mean, Churchill had started out in the Liberal Party, and then he switched to the Conservative Party. He was not considered even a much of a team player, even within his own party. He was held in some distrust by many, and that comes out during the movie Darkest Hour.
Yeah, it's interesting the point that, of course, his moment to shine is the Britain's finest hour was largely a result of policies advocated by one Winston Churchill.
Yes, well, this is right. I mean, it was this Norwegian campaign to put him into office. See, Churchill's political career required war. As long as there was peace, Churchill was out of power. Churchill, from the end of from the 1920s up until 1940 or 1939, with the advent of the Second World War, he was in the wilderness, so to speak.
Yeah.
his career depended on war. He liked war. I mean, this comes out by any good biographer of Churchill brings out how much he liked being in charge and liked being managing things during wartime. He reveled in that. So that's a point that many, many historians have brought out. A good book on that subject, by the way, is Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War by Patrick J. Buchanan.
Yes.
And brings this out very well in his book. It's a book I strongly recommend. Buchanan is not an original historian, but he's a very good synthesizer of information from many others, and he puts, as he always does, in a readable narrative that helps clarify things, make things understandable to the general public. So he brings this out, that Churchill's personality was like this, that he liked war and depended on it. Without war, he didn't have a career.
Yeah, and the book, it's an unearthing of arguments and points of view that were generally accepted at the time, but I guess in the subsequent years, the triumphalism of the war and the necessary for propaganda for the Cold War has long since been forgotten.
Tim, that's a very important point, because during the Second World War, of course, there was a great deal of propaganda, but there was a lot of very thoughtful, admirable writing done on history during the 1950s and 60s that's been largely forgotten. Men like Charles Beard, John T. Flynn, Tansel, A.J.P. Taylor, William Henry Chamberlain wrote very, very good books about the Second World War that were that rebuked the standard narrative of the war, but they've been largely forgotten. And now movies like The Darkest Hour are expressions of this kind of triumphalist mainstream establishment official view of the Second World War, and this movie is a good example of that kind of propaganda take on the Second World War.
Yeah, this is the necessity for revisionism, which is a sort of a reaccounting or fresh look at some of these historical events that the narratives we've been fed throughout the years, and realize that the victors do write the history books. And I think Winston Churchill even boasted of that. Someone asked him one time how he expected history to treat him. He says, "I expect it to treat me well because I intend to write it."
Right, and he did. He wrote an impressive multi-volume history of the Second World War, for which he received a Nobel Prize in Literature. And I've read it very, very carefully. I've gone through it very carefully. But especially in recent years, there's been a number of historians who have poked some big holes in Churchill's narrative of the Second World War. And this review, I think, brings out some essential points that anyone who is really interested in understanding the Churchill legacy and the Second World War in any kind of objective, sober sense should take to heart.
Yeah, I was reading Harry Emil Barnes' book, I guess it's a book he edited about various authors, Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace.
Right.
And he's got a quote from, this shows you the diversity of thought back in the mid part of the 20th century. Because this is an editor for the Arizona Daily Star, a mainstream press of its day, I guess. Of course, there was a lot more diversity and free thought in the press than in those days. But he writes, "I charge that the articulate publicists of our countries, by their semi-hysterical words in print and speech in which they champion extremes of diplomatic and military policy, are driving us rapidly into a war of unlimited and unattainable objectives, which will bring on a gigantic catastrophe of ruin and revolution at home and abroad. By articulate publicists, I mean those speakers and writers, ranging horn editors, novelists, magazine writers, columnists, dramatists, radio writers, lecturers, college professors and educators, to senators and other elected officials, cabinet members, political leaders and presidents, when they write and talk about what about becomes a united theme of agreement, actions follows as certainly as butter follows from churning of sour cream. After fighting two world wars within a generation to defend democracy and freedom, with no result other than to see those ideals recede throughout the world, we shall be blind if we do not understand that a third such war, fought for equally unlimited and unattainable objectives, will end in one of the greatest catastrophes of history. For us to imagine that we can fight such a war without exhausting ourselves and destroying much of the good faith required for the functioning of democracy is to indulge in the same wishful thinking that twice has proved our political undoing. William R. Matthews, editor, Arizona Daily Star. I'm guessing that was written sometime in the 1950s.
Right. I don't remember the exact thing, but it's really interesting to note, as you pointed out, that there were some very, I think, sober words of warning from many editors that we do not see in our present time. Just to give a real current example, the United States' involvement in Syria is, by, I think, any objective standard, illegal. There's no justification in American law. It's illegal by the U.S. Constitution. It's illegal under international law. It's not justifiable, I think, for any number of reasons. And yet the American media has been almost, mainstream media has been virtually silent in criticizing the U.S. involvement, not only by Trump, but also by Obama in the Syria conflict. Now, it's understandable in a way that many Americans don't pay much attention to these wars because they take place in countries they have a hard time finding on a map. And the number of casualties of actual Americans is pretty limited. But these wars are, at the very least, if you want to be cynical about it, very, very costly. They're very, very bad just in terms of money, not to speak of, course, the large numbers of people who are killed who live there and the thousands of Americans who are killed in these conflicts. But the media, the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, also these Wall Street Journal, are virtually in lockstep in applauding these wars when they take place. When they go south, they go bad, then you'll find some critical voices raised. But the cheering going on for these seemingly endless U.S. wars, regardless of whether the president is a Republican or a Democrat, is a real indictment, I think, of our mainstream media.
Yeah, and what's happened is that simply those people who do raise objections and point out these problems, inconsistencies, the lies being told by our foreign policy establishment, by the Pentagon, and these things, simply don't get the jobs. They don't get tenure. They don't get attention because the salaries aren't there. So this is how they stifle opinion. The rewards aren't there for people who have the courage to speak up about these things.
Well, as you are familiar, I'm sure, Tim, about the famous farewell address by Eisenhower in 1961, just before he left the White House. He warned of the danger of power, whether sought or unsought, by what he called the military-industrial complex. And people go along with it because its power, its influence, is just pervasive in American society. Much of the media and people in political life, they just go along with it because it's a lot easier to go along with it than to raise uncomfortable, unpleasant objections when most people, there's not much political gain in questioning these wars. Afterwards, of course, people are somewhat embarrassed, but it's amazing that people who got it so wrong with the Iraq War, for example, like Hillary Clinton or all sorts of commentators, they're not scorned and driven into the shadows for having gotten it so wrong about the Iraq War, which was launched on the basis of lies, deceit, and propaganda, as almost everybody now acknowledges. But instead, they're still these same people that supported that war. They might say, oh, well, yeah, that was a mistake, but they're still regarded as reliable guides to foreign policy today when they're calling for new wars. It's really astonishing. And that's one of the reasons why reminding people of this record of deceit and of failure is very important because the cost of doing this over and over again is a very, very high one.
Yeah, and of course, an early example of succeeding by failing is Winston Churchill.
Well,
I mean, every policy advocate led to disaster, and he was there to step in to supposedly deal with the crisis.
Well, that goes to another point, and that it, very often Americans view wars not as whether they are successful or not, or unsuccessful in terms of the goals of the war. It's considered good if there's merely a military victory, or at least the soldiers come home again. the political aims of the Second World War were not achieved by the United States or Britain. The military aims were achieved, but not the political aims. And over in America, we go to war for aims that are not achieved. There's a failure in doing that, as has happened many times. But Americans tend to forget that because they focus just on, well, we win. And also, like a football team, win or lose, if our team is out there playing on another field, win or lose, people come back and life goes on much the same here. And that's a real problem because war means something very different for people in Europe or Asia than it does here in the United States, because our wars, with the exception of 9/11, I suppose, all take place overseas, and the American public doesn't see the impact of them in the way that people in Europe, who are very aware of how horrible the consequences of war is for their countries, and of course Asia, the Middle East, and so forth. Because wars for Americans are far, far away. They don't impinge on us in the way, they don't have the impact on our lives that they do for other countries, because we have these big oceans and we don't we don't have bombs falling on our cities. We don't have foreign troops tromping around in our cities and killing people. So wars for many Americans are almost like sports events. They don't seem real in the way that war really is, of course, for millions and millions of people in the 20th and 21st centuries in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia.
Yeah, and since the first Gulf War and CNN, war took on a spectator sport element. You're right. It's a perverse form of entertainment for most Americans. Obviously, for the families that lose loved ones overseas or have to deal with their shattered bodies when they come back, shattered bodies and minds, the effects of war are perhaps more direct or more real. But the vast majority of Americans, really, they'll watch it on the news. They'll watch who was that NBC reporter who talked about the beautiful weapons taking off? the Syria attack or beautiful missiles taking off. It was Brian Williams, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and if you remember the run up to I remember the Gulf War, and you had things like the Scud Stud, remember Arthur Kent? And it was really perverse. And, you know, this handsome reporter reporting from Saudi Arabia, reporting on the Scud missiles coming in. But you had the sort of this put on show, the high tech weaponry that the Pentagon was showing off in the first Gulf War, which now was propaganda. A lot of those abilities were overstated for propaganda purposes. But even in the Iraq invasion, you had, if you watched Fox News or CNN, they'll get into details of the type of weapons that are being used in the attacks, and you have these DOD, you know, spokespersons or analysts coming on, former generals or colonels talking about how great these weapons are, and it's a form of entertainment.
This is particularly true about the Second and First World Wars, because the Second World War, First World War, were catastrophes for everybody involved except the United States, except for the men who were actually wounded or killed. The First and Second World War were great for America. During the Second World War, there was full employment, prosperity, the economy boomed, and America came out of the Second World War top dog in the world. America came out of that war as the one big country that hadn't been destroyed. The Second World War was catastrophe and ruin for the peoples of Europe and Asia, but for the United States, the Second World War, except again, as you say, for the people who were actually getting shot and wounded and maimed, was a great time. It was a time that not only was prosperous at home, but the United States came out of it better than ever, top dog in the world. And that's why one of the reasons why Churchill and many of the reviewers of this movie Darkest Hour brought this out. Churchill is more of an icon in America than he is in Britain. If you're going to find a good guy, supposedly from the Second World War, well, it's hard to pick Stalin. Republicans are not very comfortable with Roosevelt. And, of course, the United States didn't even get in the war until Pearl Harbor. So the one supposedly good guy from the U.S. point of view is Churchill, but he's more of this iconic figure in American propaganda, you might say, in the American media, than he is even in Britain.
Yeah, and that maybe perhaps that's something American about it. We need comic book good guys, bad guys, simplistic narratives.
I think Tim, that's an extremely important point because the United States does not have the same cultural, racial, ethnic, religious identity that most other countries have. Americans often see themselves, and the Americans like to see the country in terms of good versus bad. We're the good guys. And how does a good guy, how does a Superman prove he's good, or Spider-Man? He's out fighting bad guys. And so there's a greater need, I think, in the United States because of the nature of American society to have bad guys to be fighting than there is in other countries. And that's why there's always a new quote-unquote Hitler coming down the road that our leaders and our media tells us we've got to destroy, even though the bad guy often used to be a good guy.
Yes.
I mean, Saddam Hussein, we're told, was like a new Hitler. He had to be eliminated. He's terrible. Well, he had been an ally, or at least a kind of ally, during the eight-year war between Iraq and Iran. The United States has helped Iraq because it was even more angry at Iran. The Assad family in Syria was a kind of U.S. ally earlier on, and then of course now Obama said no, he's terrible, and for Hillary Clinton, Putin is another Hitler. I mean, this is bringing down world policy and foreign policy down to a very simplistic way in which, and it's just not accurate. It's not how life is. The world is not divided into good guys and bad guys. As Solzhenitsyn said, evil is something that, and good and evil is in each human being. All human beings are capable of good. We're also capable of evil. And to divide the world into that kind of thing is not only simplistic, but dangerously so. Dangerously simplistic.
Yeah, and I don't think it's an intellectual error on the part of our supposed leaders. Obviously, there's geopolitical gamesmanship going on here. There's international financial intrigues. Every time there's a new Hitler in a region, usually you can spot something like, I don't know, oil fields, pipelines. They foment these wars to create a pretext for intervention, you know, to weaken a country, to get access to its resources, to control the resources, like the Middle East, you know, or the Caucasus, these things. And ironically, although many Americans like to think it's good guys versus bad guys, if you look beneath the surface, it's the intelligence agencies that are fomenting the bad guys to create the pretext for the intervention or to destabilize a country. A good example is United States history of supporting and fomenting Islamic radicalism and using it against Russia, or in Afghanistan, or in Chechnya, you know, or in the Balkans, or in the 90s, we tore that country apart. Yugoslavia was literally torn apart by the U.S. Congress, so years later we could go in and certain interests, not we, I'm sorry, it's corporate interests, can go in and get control of the raw materials, the resources, or even exploit the cheap labor.
Well, yes. I mean, of course, people in power don't want any wars. It's going to be really contrary to their economic interests, of course. But one of the sad realities is that some of these recent wars haven't even been good for that reason. There was all sorts of thought about how the United States was going to benefit from Iraqi oil after the Iraq war. Well, that didn't even work out the way that we were told. And very often, even the economic calculations prove to be false ones, and they don't work out the way
people. You mean the war didn't pay for itself? I thought.
Well, supposedly, yeah, we were going to benefit, and all these American oil companies were kind of come in. Well, Iraq today is actually much more aligned with Iran, and they've the Parliament of Iraq has pointedly rejected American investment in Iraq. There's not, America doesn't have many friends in Iraq. I mean, most Iraqis think the war was a was a horrible catastrophe, and they don't want to see that happen. And because, look, I mean, one of the realities is the world is just very different than it was during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, because America's relative place in the world has declined over time, because the rest of the world has recovered and built up from the Second World War. Right after the Second World War, 1948, 49, 50, something like 90% of the automobiles in the world were made by the big three Detroit automobile companies. Mm-hmm. Today, more automobiles are manufactured in China than in the United States and Japan combined. America is increasingly unable to sell its products overseas, whereas in the 50s or 60s, if people in Latin America or the Middle East wanted to buy tractors, they bought Caterpillar tractors. American cars were exported all over. That has all changed. The situation is very, very different. And it's always dangerous, especially to make policy on the assumption that we're still the top dog, when the actual relationship of power economically, financially, and so forth has actually changed in the world. And we see in the last 10, 20 years, America's military adventures have been one failure and fiasco after another in Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan. And that's why there's very little real public support for these wars, because even though the public might get a temporary boost in supporting them, the long-term consequences are actually catastrophic. And going back to the Second World War, as even Churchill acknowledged, at the end of the Second World War, Britain was bust. Britain was just in ruin. Its empire ruined, its economy completely in hock to the United States. It had failed even to live up to its promises of support in Eastern Europe for freedom and so forth. That turned out just to be a complete disaster for Britain. So Britain didn't win the Second World War. It came out on the winning side, you might say, because it was still allied with the United States and the Soviet Union, which were the real victorious powers of the Second World War.
And that's an important point, because we're getting into sort of this, the reason why a character like Winston Churchill is still lionized and promoted, because the Second World War solidified in the eyes of many and in the eyes of accepted views of what that event taught us. The war itself was the necessity and the righteousness of perpetual American intervention abroad. And that was right. Such a change from America's historical in the 1920s, where people called isolationism, but it really was just non-interventionism, sort of a measured proper intervention or interaction with America, with the rest of the world, not just interventionism. And of course, the 1920s, when we saw, you know, the first era of revisionism, that's what Harry Emil Barnes writes about a lot. You know, this whole idea of the merchants of death, the congressional investigations and the profiteering and these things, and sort of how people realized they had been had, and they realized that just stay out of Europe's fights, stay out of Europe's squabbles and these things. And the 20s sort of seemed to, ratify that view, because the horrible experience of the First World War, but the Second World War seemed to say, well, because of characters like Stalin and Hitler, although oddly enough both were creations of American interventionism, no one wants to look back 20-30 years. It's always what happened yesterday. You know, it's always 1941 or 1938. They don't look back to 1917 or 1923 or 1932 or something. But both the Bolsheviks and National Socialism were a development or a creation of policies or intervention in Germany and Russia itself. The Nazis emerged, you know, from you could say from the hunger blockade and, you know, from the Great Inflation and the Versailles Treaty and the humiliation that Germany felt in the 20s and 30s. And the Bolsheviks, of course, people have done studies that the Bolsheviks were heavily funded by Western banking interests because they wanted to destabilize Russia. Certain interests within banking and also Jewish interests in the West wanted to take Russia out. But my point is that World War II seemed to solidify the necessity of American intervention everywhere. Harry Emil Barnes, I think, called it globaloney, as in baloney, globaloney. And he made the point, I was reading this in his summation on perpetual war for perpetual peace, is if you, you know, people think Americans need to be engaged in the world, we need military to keep the sea lanes open, have bases everywhere to expand, to protect freedom abroad and expand trade. But if you just did an accounting, what we paid for in lives and spilled blood, spent treasure in the military intervention, the wars abroad, far exceeded anything we gained from increased foreign trade.
Right. No, that's very true. I mean, I remember in the run-up to the Iraq war, the oil minister of Iraq went on television. He says, he said, look, we just want to sell oil. I mean, the basic point is you're going to get much more oil just by buying it than you're ever going to get by going to war to try to seize oil that way. I mean, the thing's crazy. It's just really, really bad. And I mean, one of the big points over and over is that the world is just different than it was in the 1940s or 50s, and especially in the 60s. America was in the 40s, 50s, late after the Second World War for years. It was the huge creditor nation of the world. Mm-hmm. It was the exporter of products of the world. The world is just different. It's a different world. And there's no going back to the very artificial situation of the 1950s and 60s that was due to the destruction of the Second World War that left most of the world in ruins. And we're getting a little off the topic, but we can't just dial back the clock to 1960. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. The world's changed. America has changed. And learning from these lessons, learning from what actually happened is very important, and not seeing these kinds of things in terms of good guys, bad guys, we win, they lose. That's not how it works in reality, because very often people can win militarily, quote unquote, and lose in every meaningful way for the lives of people in the world, Americans in the world.
And America has become an empire, starting probably an overseas empire in 1898, end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. But as America has involved herself abroad routinely now, or as a matter of policy, that's what foreign policy is now, just knee-jerk American interventionism abroad. You have to do something. If there's something going on somewhere, we have to react. We have to say something. We have to do something. Of course, the reality of that is that the American people lose control of their own government, and it gets taken over by narrow special interest foreign governments. I would argue that in the first half of the 20th century, America was taken over largely by Anglo interests, financial interests, because one thing is opinion that mattered in America was all Anglophile. It was the East Coast establishment and all that. So America was... The vast majority of Americans were used as fodder to protect their interest, and particularly try to prop up the British Empire. So, and in the second half of the 20th century, probably largely because of the war itself, particularly after 1967, that U.S. foreign policy has been taken over largely by the Israeli lobby, from the 1970s on, and maybe as we sit back in wonderment, look at the disaster of Iraq. Disaster of Syria, and what's going on there? Well, there is one group that may see itself as benefiting from those policies. That is the Israeli lobby.
Well, we're getting away from Churchill, but certainly you've spoken a great deal about that. To me, it's obvious, and it's obvious to the world, really, that the drum beating for war with Iran is almost entirely motivated by people who want to help Israel. The entire world has a consensus, basically, about Iran and the situation. It's only in the United States and Israel that are eager for and threatening war with Iran. Such a war would be and the whole world understands, would be a catastrophe. The only country that benefits and the only applauding for such – in fact, the American public doesn't even – whole show Americans don't really want the war either. But the pro-Israel lobby – Netanyahu the politicians who are supported by those interests in the United States, of course, are going along with these dangerous threats, I think, against Iran. And that's the looming prospect of a war in the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it was theatrical or whatever, but it's far better that we did sit down and make some sort of concord with the leader of North Korea – And of course, around the world, people say, well, if you make a deal and shake hands with the leader of North Korea, which has nuclear weapons, it should be possible to do so with Iran, which doesn't have them, which has said it's foregoing. It's not building nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But the United States policy on these things is obviously very inconsistent. And the big reason, of course, is that the interests that want to go to war with Iran are very, very powerful in American political life.
Now, you also penned another interesting article regarding, this is all part of the war propaganda, is how the German army, the Wehrmacht, is treated in popular historical accounts, movies, and these things. How the German army was perhaps man for man, the best trained, best equipped army, and then why did it lose?
I'm showing my age, I guess, but when I was young, a boy, one of the most popular TV shows was called Combat, and it was a weekly show starring Vic Morrow, who played Sergeant Saunders, and he and his team of Americans. The show went on for several years, even though it supposedly shows American troops in France in 1944. They were only there, really, from June to August, September 1944, but the series went on. But even as a kid, I was struck by the way that German soldiers were portrayed week after week in this series. They were portrayed as wooden-headed, stupid. A small team of Americans could wipe out 50-60 Germans. The German soldiers would start running into American machine guns and all get knocked off. And, of course, there was this very, very popular show called Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, yes.
Now, of course, it's a comedy, but the Germans were just stupid as all get out. I mean, the Americans just could do anything, and the Germans were portrayed as just absolute morons, wooden-headed, who followed orders and didn't look into anything and think about anything. Now, more than that, though, there's many other examples of in American motion pictures and so forth, not as extreme as Combat or Hogan's Heroes, which portray American soldiers as cool, resourceful, creative. And German soldiers are essentially, yeah, they'll follow orders, but they're not very creative or imaginative. And this portrayal has been reinforced in numerous American movies, television series, and so forth. And it's entirely wrong. And the point of the article, which is on our website, and which also was just recently picked up by the UNS Review website, quotes and cites any number of historians and data to show that the German military during the Second World War was outstanding. I mean, there was no match for it, really. It was superior in every significant way. To the Allied forces, and particularly and Americans. I mean, anyway, that's the point of this article, and I cite a whole lot of it. Now, the point of the article is really one that there's a consensus of military historians. Historians know this. I mean, there's not a single reputable, knowledgeable military historian who doesn't understand the point of this article, but the public doesn't know this. And the point of the article is to lay out all of this in a readable way for the more general public in a convincing way, because on so many issues, what specialists know is one thing, what people who are knowledgeable know is one thing, but on the other hand, the public gets this very, very skewed impression through motion pictures and the media and so forth, and politicians on the other hand.
Yeah, I mean, there's always you get that same thing with, I mean, obviously the favorite generals are Rommel and Hans Gregorian, these great generals, and there's always the losing generals. You know, Robert E. Lee, right? Stonewall right. Jackson. But if you look at the victorious forces always seem to simply have numbers. Right, it was quantity over quality, and you also see that interpretation of the so-called American Civil War, where particularly like in the Wilderness campaign in 1864, where Grant is just throwing men into the meat grinder, knowing he can make good his losses because he has a bunch of Irish streaming in from impoverished Ireland to right. fill the ranks, right. and Lee can't, and it's sort of it becomes a war of attrition. It's rather brutal, but right. you know it's. Oh. It,
That's a very good comparison, because it's not just in terms of numbers of men. The North had far, far greater economic resources. Mm-hmm. The South didn't. The South was more or less blockaded after 1862. It was not able to produce weapons and produce things in the way the North could. It wasn't just and a similar thing in the Second World War. The economic and human resources of the United States, and particularly the Soviet Union, were just far greater than that of Germany and its allies during the Second World War. And again, this is a very important point, too, that the primary victory of the Second World War against Germany wasn't carried out by the United States. It was carried out by the Soviet Union. Now, again, this isn't a reflection that the good, because it's not true that the good guys necessarily win. History isn't like that. History belongs to the winner, and the winner says he's good, of course, and that's the way we remember the thing. But the big military victor of the Second World War was, of course, the Soviet Union. 3/5 or 80%, something like that, of German divisions were on the Eastern Front, not on the Western Front. The D-Day invasion by U.S. and British forces at Normandy in June of 1944 took place less than a year before the end of the war. The decisive battles that had already essentially decided the outcome of the war had already been fought on the Eastern Front. In Stalingrad, the Kursk, Orel campaign, by the time the Americans landed in Normandy, the German Air Force was really devastated. And the Germans were unable to really mount. I mean, the Western allies, the United States and the British, had just really air superiority dominance over Western Europe by the time the Americans landed in Normandy in June 1944. But Americans, of course, through motion pictures and so forth, have this image of the American role, the D-Day invasion, as being decisive. Well, it wasn't. What was really far more decisive was the Soviet role. And Americans aren't really told that. Now, with regard to the German soldiers, Germans were better trained. They were better motivated. Americans didn't have the same sense of the necessity of the war that, of course, German soldiers had. They felt, well, 1944, they were defending their country. They were defending against invasion. So the morale of Confederate soldiers was better than that of Union soldiers, because Confederates viewed that overwhelming, they were fighting to defend their land from being taken over. And so that was an important factor. But another factor that's not so well known is that, in general, the quality of the equipment of the German military was superior to that of the Americans. And this is something else that comes out in the article. German machine guns, tanks, generally their artillery, were superior to those of Americans and British during the Second World War. And again, these are points that historians understand. There's a consensus about these points, but the public in America doesn't really know that very well.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of admiration for the weaponry, but I think your point about the morale and ingenuity of the individual soldier, the reason why that's covered up is because people don't want to humanize the enemy. They want to see Germans as automatons, and right. You know, and so if you know, this fits the vision of the war. And this is something that's I noticed if you watch war movies, it's something that's it's something that's developed since the 1970s. Whereas if you see at war movies from the 50s and 60s, Germans are portrayed much more, I want to say fair, or just there's more realism to it. But the cartoonish, right. You know, portrayal of Germany as just being, you know, either being an automaton or being evil was something that as the vision of the war has become more cartoonish and surreal or you know, kind of propagandistic since the 1970s. And this is largely because it's serving a particular agenda. And it's like in the 1960s, the understanding of the conflict, nature of the conflict of the American Civil War, well, slavery became more of an issue because of the contemporary political issues. When you read about in treatments of the war in the early part of the 20th century, they talked more about tariffs and state rights and the constitutionality and these things and the idea of union. And then it became, you know, so you're, again, this goes back to our original point, I guess. What we're talking about is this interpretation of the war, this sort of historiography changes with the needs of modern-day propaganda.
Right. That's a very important point, that we've seen an increasing polemicization. I mean, conflicts are looked now from the, you might say, politically correct vision of the perspective of the present. And looking back, they say, well, they're bad guys. There was far more fairness, you might say, to Confederate soldiers from about 1890 up until the 1960s or 70s. Today, it's astonishing that a man like Robert E. Lee, who was held in high regard by virtually all Americans for a century, is now being, his statues are being torn down and he's being degraded in this way because it's a political polemicizing of the conflict, an ideological being viewed from the ideology of the present. And the same thing with the Second World War. I mean, you don't have to agree with the cause of a country fighting in the war to understand and to acknowledge the ability and skill and daring and creativity of soldiers and people in conflicts. And there's more of that in around the world than there is in the United States. This is particularly true in the United States. And this is a reflection, really, of just the galloping ideological polemicizing of American society that's been going on now for some time and is reaching a point where they tore down a statue of Stephen Foster in Pittsburgh. They took away the name of the author of Little House on the Prairie from an award. This is just astonishing what's going on in America. And as part of that is a kind of demonization of Germans during the Second World War, not merely the regime, but just even the ordinary soldiers.
Yeah, the tearing down of these statues is almost like ripping away the history from people. And you don't have these historical statues. At the very least, if you're in like New Orleans and there's a statue of Jefferson Davis, at the very least, it sparks a conversation, right?
Yeah.
And also the people's identities of where they live is they give directions based on the statue, and you're destroying local identity. And so it's this marching globalism. And that's
it's hard to see how the United States can even have an identity if all of the central figures of American history are all demonized. I mean, there's not a culture left, really. There's no continuity whatsoever. If a person being a slave owner is just ipso facto evil, well, we don't have very many early Americans to admire at all. There's hardly any American history to look back on. It's just insanity, really. But this is another aspect of looking at history that's, I think, a very important one, and that is, it's very dangerous, what's called presentism. That is to look back and judge the past by the standards of the present. And it's especially arrogant when one considers that the standards of the present keep changing. They keep changing. We've seen, even in our own lifetime, you might say a full-scale revisionism taking place in our textbooks and in our life, so that people who are considered good guys are now considered bad guys. I mean, that's one of the ironies, is that there's a lot of bad-mouthing of so-called revisionism, but that's taking place full bore, full scale in the United States now, right now, tearing down statues and rewriting books and so forth.
Yeah, and at the same time, all this energy and time is wasted on debating to take down a statue when you're not, and that's time not being spent on maybe arguing about what's going on right now. It's a, you know, at the same time, like we, here in Virginia, we had a man running for the Senate who got the nomination for the Republican Party, who's against the iconoclasm of tearing down these Confederate statues and these things. And he's now considered controversial. So to not to be an iconoclast is now to being an extremist. Well, in my view, actually, the people tearing down statues and digging up graves, to me, that's extreme. I mean, they dug up Nathan Bedford Forrest's grave. You don't dig up people's graves.
Oh, yeah.
No, and the people doing it have no understanding of the nature of the conflict, the Civil War. All they know is what they've been told in high school or what they may pick up in college or a textbook. But they have no understanding of the complexity of these events, which it shows in their behavior. You know, they're trained, they're brainwashed, they're not educated, definitely not educated.
Well, not just merely uneducated. What it does is it feed a kind of hubris, a self-importance, it gives people a sense of moral superiority by kicking down people who can't defend themselves anymore, to vilify and smear people who are long dead, so that one gives oneself the kind of moral superiority is just cheap. It's despicable, really. And that's just going on a full-scale thing in America today, because there's almost nothing left except this kind of posturing for self-importance that takes place in our society across the board. We see this happening just on such a scale here in the United States. And that's why I think all the more important for some people to keep a grip on reality, keep a grip on a sober understanding of the past, if we're to have any future whatsoever. Our goal, our target is not the vast majority of the public. We don't have Warner Brothers motion pictures, and we don't have big Hollywood studios, but we are and should be able to reach intelligent, thoughtful, especially younger people who can and must be leaders in the future if we're to have any future whatsoever. Because things have gotten so out of hand that just drifting along the way we are is a society without any moorings, any foundation whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and America is particularly vulnerable to this because we're, as you said earlier, we're sort of identify on ideals, and we're a proposition nation. We're not really based on an ethnic history or soil, things like this that older nations might have. So once we lose these reference points, you know, we're sort of this force for instability. It's almost like a like a nuclear reaction or something about to go off.
Why they glorify Churchill. Now remember, one of the odd things about Winston Churchill is that by today's politically correct standards, Churchill was nobody to write home about. Churchill was by every standard very political. I mean, he was a racist. He was just completely contemptuous of non-whites. He was a unavowed imperialist. He believed that Britain should maintain permanent control over India and this huge empire. I mean, that's one of the ironies in the Second World War. The most imperialistic country involved in the Second World War was Britain, which had hundreds of millions of people held against their under their control against their will, most notably India, of course, which includes modern-day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh at that time. But, Churchill was, he was hopelessly politically incorrect by today's standards. But I guess that's all forgiven because he was against Hitler, so mm-hmm. that makes okay, I guess, but that's very, very simplistic and silly, really. But again, this is, again, part of the problem we're dealing with and why I think it's very important the kind of work that those of us who are trying to set the record straight and keep a grip on the reality are trying to do.
Yes, yeah. And so, well, Mark, I think we covered it. Do you have anything else to observe? Think of
No, you made very good points, and I'm particularly glad that the discussion we have relates these points to the present and the crisis of our own time. This is, I think, very important because these historical lessons we try to learn aren't just in a vacuum. They have important consequences for our time and for our future. And I'm particularly glad that you made a point of tying a lot of this with the Second World War and other wars in with our present here in America.
That's sort of like that forged modern America, Second World, the fires of the Second World War, completed the job. It's a long process. Right. So yeah, well that's, thank you, Mark. Mark Weber, he is the director of the Institute of Historical Review. That's IHR.org?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
That's the website. And people can go there, look at their material. I guess they can buy the material. Is that how you get your principally support? You sell publications?
Well, like most organizations like this, our main source of income are donations, are people okay. who give us money. But we sell and make available a large number of books, including I mentioned Pat Buchanan's book. We offer that for sale. Many other, I think, valuable and I think pretty solid books and recordings are available from our website, and I think it's well worth it. I'd like to say, of course, to visit the IHR website.
Of course, yeah. Well, listen. Well, thank you. I'll let you go.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
I know it's a little earlier out there, so go grab dinner.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.